long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Warndorf, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I am joined by Ken Katkin, a professor of law at Chase Law School. Ken, welcome back to The Politics Guys.
It is great to be back.
Yeah, well, you know, as a result of switching a schedule a little bit, it's been a little bit longer since we've been on the show. So it's good that we can put the moderates to the side and have the true voices of reason back on the show once every few weeks. I don't know why I have to tease Jay and Mike so much, but it's just a requirement, I think, of this role.
Yep, they've earned it.
Well, Ken, there has been, you know, we always kind of, part of the running joke is that all the greatest stories up when we're on the show. And I feel like, once again, that is the case. We've got a lot of things going on this week, but I think nothing bigger than what happened this past Thursday on the Senate floor when Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the most senior Jewish Democrat in Congress, took the floor and took aim at Israel, and probably even more clearly at Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, specifically what Schumer argued is that Netanyahu should never have come together with what he called, quote, far-right extremists, end quote, and has been, quote, too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows, end quote. In short, he wants there to be new elections. But now that seems a little bit odd to me, Ken, because we've covered what happened in the last set of Israeli elections. Voters just 2 years ago in 2022 had the three largest parties in their legislature being, well, Netanyahu's with 23.41% of the vote, Yatid with 17.78% of the vote, and then the religious Zionists with 10.83% of the vote. Nobody else cracks 10%. Leftist parties, many of them didn't even meet the minimum threshold. And so in all honesty, while I think there's a lot to admire in Schumer's speech, I've got it up in front of me, I've read it in its entirety, I think that this kind of central idea that a new election will somehow create a left government that's going to fix the crisis, in his view, seems to sit precisely at zero. But I do agree with a lot of what he has to say in part. But one issue that I was curious about your take on to start with, a lot, I mean, this is a long speech, is, you know, he seemingly conflates the Israeli democratically elected parties, who, yes, some of them are on the right, to being equally at harm with Hamas as one of four major problems. And that seems problematic at best. And I'm curious what you thought about that, Ken.
Yeah. So first, let's summarize for the listeners. Schumer identified, as you said, four major obstacles to peace in Israel and Gaza, and he numbered them. So number one was Hamas. He says Hamas and the Palestinians who support and tolerate their evil ways. That's the number one obstacle to peace.
And then number two.
Number two was radical right-wing Israelis in government and society. Number three was the Palestinian Authority president, Mahmoud Abbas. And then number four was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So he identified Netanyahu as one of the four main obstacles to peace, but he did rank him fourth out of four, I guess. So So maybe he didn't equate him with Hamas. But I think he made a good case for why Netanyahu is an obstacle to peace and why peace could be, you know, it won't be easy no matter who's prime minister, but there'd be more of a chance of attaining it if it weren't Netanyahu, because both because of the sense that probably both Israelis and Palestinians have that Netanyahu is never going to go for a two-state solution, which is it's a provocation to the Palestinians and to the whole Arab world, really. And also the sense that Netanyahu especially doesn't care whether whether he turns Israel into an international pariah state, whereas other Israeli prime ministers have cared about international opinion. I think that Schumer's right on both those counts, and so I think he was right to call for it.
But, I don't agree with that, but I guess my question is, we covered this significantly, so put aside the ideological part. It doesn't seem likely that new election. I mean, this was an unstable, long-standing set of elections where, you know, nobody thought Netanyahu's coming back, but he ends up doing it through a coalition government. So, to be clear, I'm not necessarily trying to say yes, I back Netanyahu, but I'm not sure that this. I guess my question for Schumer is, what's the alternative going to be? You're going to have another one of these elections, and it's probably likely that Netanyahu wins again. So are you saying that the Democratic elections are flawed? I don't think that would happen.
Now I see. So, no, I think Schumer's actually predictively correct that Netanyahu couldn't get elected again because, you know, even though Netanyahu had, you know, as you pointed out, more votes than anyone else in the last few elections, although it was still, you know, only about a quarter of the votes.
Well, organizations that he calls out, the religious Zionists, is the third biggest.
Right. But I think of the 25% of Israelis who voted for Netanyahu and for his Likud party, you know, not certainly you're right about the further right parties. They're not going to change stripes. But a lot of Netanyahu's appeal to Israeli voters was that they thought that he could protect the country better than the parties to his left. And public opinion on that has changed completely. So I think, you know, His approval ratings were never much higher than 50%, but now they're around 10%. And I think a lot of the voters who actually voted for him would not vote for him again. And I think Gantz in particular has really emerged as being, a candidate who security voters actually trust more than they vote Netanyahu, and more than they would trust Netanyahu to protect security. Because after all, he didn't protect Israel on October 7th. And I think that was kind of his brand. So I think he's more damaged than he ever was before by the events of October 7th.
I hear that. But, you know, I just recall, you know, again, the two of us seemingly were always the one who ended up talking about the Israeli thing, the Israeli elections. And we had a similar conversation in ways of, you know, this is the end of Netanyahu. And so maybe I'm a little I'm hesitant to think, because as you recall, it wasn't quite this low, but he was similarly low in polling numbers before the last go round. But over the course of that voting procedure, because again, they have a parliamentary system. We've talked about this voters before. You know, as that process moved forward, he ended up being a stability figure. And again, that's not an endorsement necessarily of Netanyahu, just an empirical analysis of this. You know, we've had a conversation similar to this, and that makes me pause and say, what did I get wrong last time? Am I potentially making a similar mistake this time?
Yeah, I don't think you had anything wrong last time, but I think what you might be missing this time is that the incredible amount of harm that the events of October 7th did to Netanyahu's political brand in Israel, because a lot of his supporters, you know, maybe, you know, would not be so troubled by, you know, his policies in Gaza, but they would be tremendously troubled by the fact that he failed to stop the attacks of October 7th. So I think he'd have a hard time getting reelected. But also the other thing we need to point out here is, no matter what Schumer says about this, there's no mechanism. We're not going to find out, because there's not going to be an election because Netanyahu himself, and also the parties further to his right that are in his coalition, would have to agree to call for an election. And they don't want to do it. But I think part of the reason they don't want to do it is because they also think Schumer is right, that they wouldn't get reelected again.
And that's an excellent point. And that's something I think sometimes forgotten in true parliamentary systems is that it is the parties that are generally calling for the election. And you don't ever call for an election when you don't think it's going to be to your benefit.
Right. Conversely, you do call for it if you think you could pick up even more seats.
Exactly. Why the United Kingdom, for example, has had tried to have kind of max levels of years in office to potentially tamp that down, have a kind of a hybrid parliamentary system. But that has its own issues having affect electoral cycle as well.
Yeah, actually, Israel has that now, too. But that number of years won't come up for a few more years.
But they have a much longer one than the United Kingdom.
Longer one. Yeah, I can't
UK
remember
only
exactly
has 4 years, and I believe it's 7 or 8 in Israel.
Yeah, I don't remember the number either, but I know you're right that it's longer than 4, and it's not coming up anytime soon. So that won't be the factor that calls for elections. It would have to be that the Knesset would actually call for elections, and I think they won't. But I think that actually does prove out, or at least tends to support Schumer's theory, that if there were new elections now, it would be hard for Netanyahu to hang on.
But this leads, I think, to the larger question, which is, and this is something that I've brought up, is that Biden has been consistently being hit on the left by pro-Palestinian voices for not stopping I'll just be honest. I mean, this has become the rallying cry on the left, the genocide of Israel. Schumer seemingly kind of walks right up to that genocide line without crossing over. And clearly, there is no way that Schumer is going to be coming out on the floor of the Senate and saying things that are going to be in complete opposition to the positions of President Biden. But at the same time, I don't think it completely gets rid of the attacks from his left, because even today, I'm taking a look at leftists saying, well, Biden's got all his people coming out, but he doesn't have, you know, he's not willing to say that it's genocide. Well, yeah, he's still failing on this issue. So what do you think this means more broadly in terms of White House policy, that this is the point where Schumer comes out and probably is a slightly more radical mouthpiece for the Biden administration?
Yeah, I'm certain that Schumer was speaking for the Biden administration, and that Schumer was sent out as the messenger because he's, the most probably pro-Zionist elected official in the country. He represents, of course, New York, where New York City has more Jewish people than Tel Aviv or Jerusalem does. It's sort of the cradle of world Jewry today, in a way. And Schumer's Jewish and very Zionist. And I think what they're trying to do, and I'll just lump Biden and Schumer together here, because I don't think there's any distance between their positions or their goals. Is that they are trying to create a little bit of a separation between being pro-Israel and being pro Netanyahu or supporting the way Netanyahu's executing the war. And I think that is going to have some practical significance. It's not just rhetorical, because Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, and U.S. military aid has continued pretty unabated, through this current conflict. And, as there's been more and more voices raised in the U.S. and particularly within the Democratic Party against unconditional U.S. support for Israel in this war, I think we're moving towards a point where Biden is going to stop that. And I think he's really going to I don't think we'll completely cut off Israel from receiving military aid or receiving arms. But I think that we probably will be seeing the U.S. move towards conditioning that none of the arms that we continue to supply them with can be used in any way in the Gaza conflict, and that all of them have to be, in the north to protect against like Hezbollah incursions from Lebanon and things like that. But that I think we will see that, because I think, A, it's not really serving U.S. interests to be aligned with the way Israel's conducting the war in Gaza right now. And B, it's definitely not serving Biden's political interests. And so I think, his political interests and our national interests are really converging on having some kind of public break that can be expressed in practical and material terms, not just in rhetorical terms. And so I do think limiting military aid and really restricting it only to military aid that won't be used in Gaza is coming very soon.
I'll say that I was appreciative that Schumer said, look, it's wrong to consider Israel, a colonist state. This is not a genocide in those terms. And I think that's good to have there. But that weirdly even still puts him outside the mainstream, Schumer, in this case, of his party. And so, Ken, I guess one of the things we had hinted at this before and chatted about it before we talked about the Hamas war, and it's going to lead into some more of the stuff we're going to talk about today. But it seems to me that the center of mass in the Democratic Party is Israel is a colonizing state that is the problem, like hard stop, period. And if you take a look at polls, if you take a look at kind of the prominent voices, that appears to be that center of gravity. And that gives me a little bit of heartburn for Democrats. And obviously, in this case, you know, oftentimes I'm the one getting heartburn from, you know, my side of the aisle. I know this is a difficult one for you. I mean, what do you think on that larger front?
Well, I think that, you know, the Democratic Party as a whole, you know, the Biden administration, Schumer in the Senate, they're never going to move that far in that direction. The Schumer's speech, which was very critical of Netanyahu, in fact, almost unprecedented in its demand that a foreign leader of an allied democracy be put out of office.
Yeah, it's a
very,
big deal.
Very, very big deal. But yet, you know, a major text, not even subtext, but just theme of the speech was how pro-Israel America is, and that in fact expelling Netanyahu will be in Israel's interest as much as in America's interest, and that Israel needs to do that, and that this is friendly advice to Israel because we're so pro-Israel. So I think that's going to continue to be the stance. It may not satisfy everyone in the Democratic coalition, but I think that the idea of saying that the Democratic Party is pro-Israel but anti-Netanyahu, and that it's in America's interests and Israel's, that a strong Israel be led by a leader who's committed to working out a two-state solution and pursuing peace from a position of strength. You know, I think that's going to be the Democratic Party position. And, you know, in the end, I think it isn't going to satisfy every Democrat, but I'm optimistic that if it's accompanied by certain, you know, tangible material issues, like I was talking about conditioning future military aid and really not providing it to the extent it's going to be used in Gaza, I think some practical steps like that that have material impact will help reunify the Democrats. And also the fact that Trump has just secured the Republican nomination, I think will help reunify the Democrats. So even Democrats who will never come around to supporting the Biden position on this issue, I don't think it's going to turn them into Trump voters.
Well, let's talk about one last thing here, and this is what I think is kind of big as well. And you had already hit on it, but I think we really need to focus. And that is the unprecedented nature of Schumer saying, this is, you need to have an election, and here's the person you shouldn't vote for. Right? That's not a subcontext. That is stated. And that violates a lot of the norms of international relations as it regards to democratic countries. Democratic countries are not supposed to interfere in each other's democratic processes. And while this is not a direct interference per se, it is certainly it pushes on the bounds of that norm to the extent you could possible without potentially crossing it. That part I found, I understand the criticism of Netanyahu, but it does worry me in the same way that sometimes, you know, we've had this conversation in terms of Trump. You know, you take away a norm, and then once that norm's gone, crossing that line becomes easier and easier. That was problematic for me personally in terms of state relationships and in terms of the legitimacies of democratic relationships. In other words, even if I disagree with your democratically elected system, I'm supposed to give that system its due. How did you feel about that portion of it?
Yeah, you know, I agree with every single thing you said in principle, but I think this was a circumstances at present do justify an exception or a departure from those norms. So I think those are good norms, but I think the reason that I think right now, I think Schumer was right to do this, even though it does violate norms and customs and would be not good if everybody did this routinely, is that, you know, Netanyahu himself has absolutely, you know, similarly formed alliances with the U.S. Republican Party. And a lot of what he does is, you know, done for the purpose of interfering with U.S. Domestic politics. So I think there's an element of, you know, tit for tat here that I think makes this much more justifiable than if it was done in connection with a foreign country that wasn't really trying to interfere in our domestic politics.
Do you think he should have made that explicit, though? Right. In short, what I say is like, I mean, he could have made the point. This is not a short speech. It wasn't intended for, you know, everybody to be reading the whole pit. This is wonky in a sense. I mean, he could have pointed out the unique nature of what he was doing as a way, as you're doing there, to say that this is so extraordinary, it allows me to violate this norm. Maybe not in those words, of course, rather than just doing it.
No, I think that's a hard thing to do because I can't think of a way he could have done that without sort of, you know, basically making this more partisan than it was. Right. And I think Schumer's concept that he's trying to get across is that both Israel's interest and the U.S.'s foreign policy interests would be served by someone different becoming prime minister in Israel. That's not being articulated in terms of U.S. domestic politics of U.S. Democrats versus U.S. Republicans. And I think it would be actually undermined if it was put in those terms. So I for that reason, I think he's right to keep it at the level of the U.S. national interest and the Israeli national interest and not to, you know, verbally get into the weeds of why, you know, in this case, he thinks because Netanyahu basically, like Putin, you know, decided to really try to manipulate our elections and support Republicans. And Netanyahu even did things like, you remember when Obama was president, Netanyahu came and spoke to the Republican House of Representatives and never even told, you know, President Obama that he's coming to Washington, you know, which is an incredible break of diplomatic protocol. And I think Netanyahu has been doing that kind of thing for so long. And also during the present conflict, you know, where the U.S. has absolutely continued to maintain and, in fact, increase, you know, our traditional levels of very high military aid to Israel. You know, every time Biden has said anything to Netanyahu about, you know, you need to make sure while we're giving you all this military aid that you have some channels open for civilian relief aid to come in, food, medicine, things like that. You know, Netanyahu has just totally ignored him in the most disrespectful way. And so I think for a foreign leader who is in you know, Israel's not exactly a U.S. client state, but it has aspects of being like a U.S. client state. But Netanyahu's kind of made it so clear that he only really has a dialogue with the Republicans here and not with the Democrats, that I think that does kind of justify the U.S. thinking about that in terms of deciding whether to violate the norm against getting involved in partisan politics in an allied democracy.
Well, let's move on to something related to this, Ken, because one of the arguments you made a second ago was that you were hopeful that Schumer's speech would be able to, especially in light of Trump being the now nominee and Biden being the official nominee for their respective parties, a chance to not have this be an issue that harms Biden, and that this might be the beginning of that go. But each of us actually saw two very similar-ish kinds of stories that we wanted to do this week. You, because of your background, saw the South by Southwest musical and tech show becoming, you know, a big point of controversy as many musicians decided to boycott South by Southwest in Austin because one of what are called the super sponsors is the United States military. And these artists argued that anyone who has sympathies for victims of war simply couldn't play. And many went even further, sporting colors of the Palestinian flag and arguing that anyone who is even secondarily connected to Israel is therefore complicit in genocide. Governor Abbott, as you might imagine, didn't have a whole lot of sympathy for that, tweeting, "Bye, don't come back," end quote, which in all honesty, I thought that was kind of funny. and then meanwhile, South by Southwest released a statement noting that it understood the reasoning and tried to kind of strike maybe more of a Schumer middle ground of the unquote unspeakable tragedies, end quote, around the world. Meanwhile, though, and a related story that I had been following, and another one kind of maybe below the radar for listeners, but I think fits in here. Johanna Chen found out that liberals and Israelis don't mix so well when he wrote about an essay, excuse me, she wrote an essay about her struggles since October 7th. The essay, From the Edges of a Broken World, created an absolute uproar in the literary community, and the publication was even removed, and the essay removed from the website. The co-publisher quit, arguing it was nothing more than, quote, a hand-wringing apologia for Zionism and an ongoing genocide in Palestine, end quote. Numerous fiction writers argued they would never come back to the publication because that piece itself, quote, was a pillar of eugenicist white colonialism masquerading as goodness, end quote, and that the essay, quote, attempts to convey empathy for a colonizing genocidal power, end quote. And to be clear, the essay itself was one person's struggle to both continue to help Palestinians that she knew, which she ultimately does in the aftermath of having some personal individuals in her life who were killed, maimed, and otherwise hurt on October 7th. It's not exactly what you would think of as eugenicist white colonialism. But that really is, as I mentioned a second ago, Ken, seems to be the center of mass on the left. Again, let's start with you, since that's your side of the aisle.
Well, I don't agree it's the center of mass. I mean, I think Joe Biden clearly does represent the center of mass on the left side of the aisle, and that's not where he is. You know, he is the president. Obviously,
when you look at current polling number, when you take a look at that right now, his position would not be the majority position among Democrats.
I'll believe you on that. I haven't looked at those polls, but I would say that his position is the official position, obviously, of the Democratic Party.
That's fair. I was thinking about in terms of the actual position being held by voters. But there's always a tension there between party positions. So I should have been more clear. Fair.
Yeah, that Biden and now Schumer and Schumer's speech, which actually goes a little further than Biden's ever gone in criticism of Israel, you know, they're still fundamentally pro-Israel. And I think even the threats to cut off some military aid, which I think will be actually done, I think that will be done. It's not to cut off all military aid. And it's always accompanied by a very strong recognition of Israel's right to exist. I think that remains, you know, certainly a very mainstream position within the Democrats. It must be if it's the official position of the Democrats. And I haven't been following the polls day to day, and I'll have to believe you if you say now most Democrats are more anti-Israel than that. But I don't think that is going to that tendency, I think it's obviously impacting where the Democrats are, because, you know, the reason Schumer, you know, did give a speech like that, I'm sure, is partly in hopes of reunifying the party by moving, you know, in the direction towards people who are more critical of Israel. And as I said, I think there'll be a little more of that, and it'll be followed up with some actual practical and material measures, not just speeches. But it's never going to get to the point where the Democratic Party where any standard bearers or even, you know, any more than just the tiniest handful of elected officials are ever going to be articulating that Israel doesn't have a right to exist.
See, I think, in all honesty, this is I don't think it's just about Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I this is one I'm going to make a prediction here. As a matter of fact, I've been reading a book and that's going to be coming out as for our podcast here in the upcoming weeks, next week, as a matter of fact, and making a really excellent point about that. And it's not particularly about Democrats, about parties, but I think that some of the insights and the summarization of the literature is accurate, is that I see in this, you know, where I think you kind of see like, okay, Biden's going to pull individuals back to the center of gravity of the Democratic Party. I think that this is the beginning of a Democratic counterbalance crack in response to the MAGA portion of the Republican Party. And I see in that the same kind of, you know, when I read educated people talking about eugenicist white colonialism, on the left, I see this as being part of that. Again, I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just empirically arguing I think that this is a response to those moves in MAGA, and I don't think Biden's going to bring it back. I think if even if Biden can win in the same way that you might think of maybe George W. Bush being kind of the last traditional conservative, I think Biden's going to be the last of your more moderate Democrat, and I see this as the beginning of that, not the end.
Yeah, I don't think that would be true at the presidential level. You know, it might become more true at the House of Representatives level, what you're saying, because of gerrymandering, basically. Like, gerrymandering benefits, you know, the candidates within their own parties who are the most extreme. And we do have a lot of gerrymandering. And I think that already explains a lot of how so many, you know, MAGA type Republicans got into the House of Representatives. And I wouldn't disagree with your prediction that we might see more of the left wing equivalents of that getting into the House of Representatives. But I think in the Senate and in the White House, where everybody has to win statewide and nationwide and therefore has to appeal to median voters, I'd be pretty surprised if we see much movement in that direction. I know it did happen with Trump, but I feel like that's just an aberration. And that's certainly not where the Democrats have been going, really, with any of their viable presidential candidates. If you look back at when Biden got the nomination in 2020, look at all the people he's up against. It's people like Buttigieg and Klobuchar. You know, Sanders was in there, of course, but there's not
Don't forget, oh, my goodness, in the Senate, Sanders and... A moment, Ken. You're missing a big name. We're both missing a big name. Warren.
Oh, and Warren. Yeah.
Warren was another huge one.
But Warren's not going to be saying that Israel doesn't have a right to exist. And Sanders isn't going to be saying that either. So I really don't see that there's really any the kind of constituency that you're talking about. If there's going to be, you know, like someone like an Ilhan Omar, you know, that's she's not going to get elected to statewide level. She's certainly not going to get elected to presidential level. But yet, you know, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, you know, they play a much bigger role in the Republican Party, I think, than Democrats like that play in the Democratic Party.
See, I think the problem with that analysis is that it downplays that these elections are now primarily not going after median voters in general elections, but are primarily concerned about turnout among their own party members, coming together with the longstanding research that campaigns don't sway individuals. And so I do think you're going to. I hear what you say, and I recognize that the median voter theory would suggest that that is what ought to happen. But I am actually firmly and purposely taking aim at that view, and suggesting that the primaries are going to push candidates to those extremes a little bit further.
I think only in the House of Representatives. I don't think that'll happen. In fact, I'll make you a bet right now that one of the major contenders for the Democratic nomination in 24 will be Governor Steve Beshear of Kentucky, who's about as opposite a candidate as to what you're talking about.
So you think Kentucky's finally going to end its curse of governors who think they're going to run for office and then do something dumb?
Yeah, I think Steve Beshear is he's like Bill Clinton in 1992. I think he's going to do very, very well.
Okay. I love it. See, I love when we get predictions that we get to look at, because then we can go forward. I like that. We got some particular predictions. I love it.
You might not agree with me that he's going to be a front runner, but you'd have to agree with me that he's about as opposite of the type of Democrat that you're talking about.
Oh, for sure. No, I would take no. I take no issue with your typology of him.
Okay. Yeah. just with my prediction that he's going to do well.
But that is a counterpoint to my overall prediction. So I love that. Okay. Well, I mean, I think, you know, we have probably spent enough time hammering on the flaws of the left.
Yeah, although actually, you know, I mean, you mentioned South by Southwest, and I would like to say a word about that. I'm going to agree with you on this one. I'm very disappointed in my side of the aisle here. I think this is insanity. So you have, you know, South by Southwest, it started out as a big music convention, music industry convention.
And then the tech kind of got
Tech became part of it. Independent film became part of it. It just grew and grew. So now it's just this massive kind of gathering of people that happens every March in Austin, Texas. And there still is a music convention part of it, but there's an independent film part of it. There's a tech part of it. And they all happen at the same time. And I'm sure people who are there for the tech convention, you know, do go out at night and see the bands that are playing and things. But by and large, it's, you know, during the daytime, you know, the people are... that are there. If they're interested in tech, they're going to the tech conference. If they're interested in film, they're going to the film conference. And you know, slowly but surely, the tech conference, which is where a lot of you know, tech entrepreneurs try to meet investors and things like that, it started drawing sponsorships, both from, I think, first actually from the CIA, and then from the CIA and the Army, and then from some defense contractors like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. And so they're just like, you know, putting in money to help subsidize the conference and to get their brand names written on things, and so that they can, you know, just ordinary advertising, really. And, you know, for some reason, you know, even though I don't believe that the Army or the CIA or the defense contractors were even sponsoring the music component of the conference, which doesn't really need sponsors as much, and weren't, and I don't think there's anything wrong with any of, you know, I mean, I'm glad we have a U.S. Army, I'm glad we have a CIA, and I say that, you know, as, again, as someone who would situate myself on the left, I think if people don't like things that the Army does sometimes, it's because that's what our political leadership is telling the Army to do. It's not because of the Army. They don't set their own agenda. And I just can't see anything objectionable about this. And I find it just very bizarre that there's now, you know, a movement, you know, that's really grown. There's a list I just saw today on MSN.com of listing, like,
isn't it?
Yeah, I think it looks to me like it's even more than that now.
Oh, all these
bands. Yeah, all these bands that are, and mostly they're bands I've never heard of, and I've heard of a lot of bands, so I don't know really. I guess like Governor Abbott, I don't know who cares that these bands aren't coming, but there's a lot of bands just saying we're not going to come play the music festival because the Army is underwriting the tech festival, and you know, I that just seems like, you know, craziness to me. It's like self-immolation to kind of destroy their own music festival because they don't like the fact that the Army of their own democracy, the Army that it protects the democracy that we live in and that follows the orders that are given to it by elected civilian leadership, is gonna funnel a little bit of money towards underwriting the very conference that they want to go to. I do feel like that's some kind of crack up and
white genocide, though.
That's
I mean, it sounds like a joke, but that really was one of like I read some of the reasons that was, you know, because they support things. It's white genocide.
So I just wanted to tell you, sometimes I agree with you when you raise these things, Trey. I really agree.
I appreciate that. Yeah. You know, and that's one of the things that makes it hard for me. You know, so for example, obviously I voted for Biden, you know, I can come by, but then you get to some of these things and I think, guys, this is the same stuff that you complain about, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you just don't like it when other people do it. But anyway,
That's why I'm siding with you on this one.
I love it.
Yeah.
Trey and can agree. although, you know, in all honesty, despite we do, I think, have major differences on some points, and that comes up. But I think one of the things that I do appreciate about when we have these conversations is we're also willing, when we're like, you know what, we agree on this.
Yeah.
and we can do that without feeling like we've lost something, which is problematic, I think, when you look at general conversations across the aisle. But let us do now move over to some Republican things. There were a lot of court things going on this week, Ken, and one of which was even happening here on Friday morning today. So let's try to get through all of this. Starting in Georgia, Fulton County Superior Judge Scott McAfee agreed with Trump's defense teams to quash, that is to end, six of the indictments against him. Or in other words, there was a problem with them. And the problem was, according to McAfee, there was a lack of detail concerning the underlying felony. Now, be clear, that still leaves 10 charges that can move forward. But This actually brings us to what we've been doing in the bonus show, because McAfee is coming back to the Constitution. And what he argues is that when a state charges an individual, they have to ensure that, as he puts it, quote, satisfy the constitutional mandates of due process and the Sixth Amendment, end quote. So McAfee argues that the reference to the terms of the of oaths being violated is so broad that there's no way the defendant can respond to it, and therefore it's lacking the essential legal elements to bring it forward. Now, Fannie Willis could go back to a grand jury, but a lot of constitutional scholars seem to have some disagreement on whether or not that should even happen, since there are still the 10 pending charges. So I'm curious about that. That's one question for you, Ken. Let's start there.
Oh, yeah, I think that in light of the other ruling that Judge McAfee made, she should go back to the grand jury and try to
So you link those two together?
Well, only because of the timelines.
Okay.
Yeah,
let me just go ahead and outline that for listeners as well, and then we can put those two together. Because the other thing that then – so that happened earlier this week. What happened this morning that I was referencing and what Ken is referencing is that McAfee made a separate ruling on this in which he argued that the defense had, quote, failed to meet their burden, end quote, in proving that Willis's relationship with Wade was a conflict of interest. However, he found that, quote, an appearance of impropriety infects the current structure of the prosecution team. And he goes on to say, quote, as the case moves forward, reasonable members of the public could easily be left to wonder whether the financial exchanges have continued, resulting in some form of benefit to the district attorney, is not exercising her independent professional judgment totally free of any compromising influences. As long as Wade remains on the case, this unnecessary perception will persist, end quote. And so just as a brief reminder, Jay and Mike actually took this up. You know, Miss Willis had to take the stand where she had to acknowledge that she had a romantic relationship with Wade. But she argued that it began after the district attorney's office hired him. There was some potential evidence early on that it might have been before, but that didn't turn up to be the same way. And that she had further argued that physical element of their relationship ended before then the indictment against Trump came up. And she also argued that she paid for roughly half of their vacations, although in a kind of a weird turn that Jay and Mike took on, you know, she claimed to do it all in cash, some unusual reasons. But so, yeah, come back to you. So how does that play in then to your answer here, Ken? Because I wasn't seeing that. So that's why you're the con law scholar.
Well, although this is actually just a strategic consideration, not a con law consideration. But I think to me, if I was Fannie Willis, my first priority would be to keep this case moving forward. And if you can keep this case moving forward, it wouldn't be worth taking the time to try to present more evidence to the grand jury that would then allow her to show with more particularity what the basis of the six dismissed charges were so that they could recharge them, but with more particularity to be responsive to Judge McAfee's ruling. But now I think she's got the time because she, you know, there's no way she can move this case forward this year if she's got to dump the lead prosecutor. Right. And so I think, you know, other people who work in her office can present discrete issues to grand juries while they're really working on starting almost from scratch in terms of the case that they're going to present to the jury because they just lost their lead prosecutor. Yeah. So that's not really a constitutional consideration. It's a strategic consideration. But I think it wouldn't have been worth taking the time to go back to a grand jury to get more charges recharged if she could get the trial started in the next couple months. But now it is a certainty that she can't get the trial started in the next couple months. So I think the cost of going back to the grand jury just got a lot lower, you know, so I think she should do it. Yeah. I think every charge that he dismissed, he dismissed on the grounds that she hadn't made clear enough exactly what conduct she was saying was illegal.
Right.
So
yes.
That opens the door to go back to the grand jury and say, let me make it clearer. You know, here's evidence of the conduct that we say is illegal and here's why we say it was illegal. So, yeah, I think there's no reason not to do that at this point.
And this brings us to another point, and I'm curious about your take on this. Jay and Mike had already touched this a little bit, so I don't want to spend a ton of time here. But it just goes to show me why in the ever-loving world did she put Wade on this case, right? I mean, anybody, anywhere, in any profession could have seen that this was going to be absolutely problematic. and you do it on what you see as being one of your centerpieces. And so I am curious about your take on that, because I can just shake, all I can do is shake my head and say, what a terrible, terrible at best lapse in judgment.
Well, I don't agree with that, actually. I don't agree that Judge McAfee's ruling was correct on this case. And I think that he should not have disqualified either Willis or Wade, because particularly based on the facts that he found, and there were some contested facts, but almost every fact that was contested, he found in Willis's favor. There's actually really nothing where he ruled against her on a factual dispute. And so the facts that he found were that she did, in fact, pay back half the money in cash, that she didn't benefit financially in any way from this arrangement, that Wade was getting paid less, that the $250 an hour he's getting paid to do this work is less than what he would be getting paid for any other work that he would be doing instead. So he's not financially benefiting from it. She didn't financially benefit from it. He also didn't find that she hired that she first had the romantic relationship and then hired Wade. He actually found that that wasn't proved, and that her testimony that she first hired Wade and then the romantic relationship started held up. And so he ultimately concluded that she didn't do anything wrong and she didn't have any conflicts of interest. And I think that's where the analysis should have ended. But then he did go on, as you said, to talk about appearances of impropriety and that there are possible bases for the court to take action if there could be the appearance of an impropriety, even if there wasn't an actual impropriety.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I think having found that there wasn't an actual impropriety, I would not have found that the equities favored any kind of court action here, because, you know, I think the main Trump argument for how Trump would be prejudiced by this was, I think it went along these lines. Trump says, well, she was in a position to hire this guy because she's the DA and she swung him this lucrative work so he could get $250 an hour. And she gave him incentives to drag things out, because the more he drags things out, the more hours he gets to collect $250 for. And then some of that comes back to benefit her financially because he's spending some of this money on her. So that's the conflict of interest. Now, another thing that Judge McAfee found, though, was that the allegation that anybody was trying to drag this out was perverse, because it's only Trump that's trying to drag this out. And the prosecutors are trying to keep things moving all the time, and Trump keeps trying to delay things all the time. And so that theory of what the conflict would be not only had no factual basis, which Judge McAfee found it had no factual basis, but whereas he thought it nonetheless created an appearance of impropriety, I find that implausible, because I don't think there's anybody who sees what's going on and says, well, Willis and Wade are the ones that are trying to delay things, and Trump's the one who's trying to get his day in court, and Willis and Wade keep delaying things just so they can keep the cash registers ringing.
Now, to be clear, though, the initial actually doesn't come from defendant Trump. The initial comes from one of the co-defendants.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But Trump's behind.
And so
that.
I think that's one of the reasons that – so I hear that narrative you're making, but keep in mind, Trump actually comes – so his defense counsel signs on to this. It doesn't come from Trump's side.
Right.
So in that case, I'm not sure the argument of, oh, you're delaying it would necessarily work, because it's not the Trump team who was initially making this argument.
But it doesn't matter which defendant, because the point is nobody looking at the case thinks that it's the prosecutor's side that's trying to delay things. But yet the whole theory of conflict of interest is based on the idea that there's incentives here for the prosecutors to delay things. And so I think if that would be the impropriety, there is no appearance of impropriety.
I'm going to pause there and just say, I hear that. I don't actually disagree on that front. However, it could be the case, right? And again, I think this is what McAfee's getting at. So if you know, and I think everyone knows Trump's tactics, so even let's say, you know, you're thinking about this in terms of Team Trump. If you were going to want to get somebody to have the most hours to bill, wouldn't you put them on Team Trump? I am not suggesting, I want to be very clear. I am not suggesting that, you know, Willis is doing that. What I'm suggesting to you, though, is that why I think McAfee has a point here is that even just that kind of argument to say, okay, I hear you. I hear you, Ken, right? Like, yeah, I picked the guy and I put him over here on it because I know this is the one that's going to get delayed 100 times.
Sure, but that wouldn't be a conflict of interest. The conflict of interest would only be if the prosecutors were the ones trying to delay it. That the prosecutors are trying to line their own pockets.
But if I know that I can make you more money by you know, assigning you to a particular kind of defendant, even if I'm not the one delaying it, I think that's part of what McAfee is getting at here, is that reasonable people could make connections that says, I can see why hiring a current or former lover is potentially a way that I was taking that into consideration here. And again, that's just one.
Yeah, but it wouldn't. I don't believe that would prejudice Trump in any way, right? For there to be, in the legal sense, an appearance of impropriety, there has to be the appearance that something about this harms Trump. So the idea that, I think what you're saying is the idea would be that, well, Trump's going to delay a lot, and so Wade is therefore going to get more money as a beneficiary of Trump's delay. That's not a conflict of interest. That's not anything that Wade is doing. You know, I think that the allegation, which is so implausible, I don't even think you're grasping what's being alleged here.
Well, that he's going to drag it on forever purposefully.
Yeah, that Wade is going to do that.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
In other words, that would be the individual that Willis has hired. Yes, yes,
yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So even if you're right that, you know, Trump, you know, it's foreseeable that Trump's going to do that. Trump's position, his chance of getting acquitted or of having a fair day in court, that would be the same no matter who the prosecutor is. If Trump's the one that's going to delay it, he's not prejudiced by the choice of Wade as prosecutor.
I hear that. But now, so again, now this is me maybe coming up against some of my knowledge. McAfee seems to argue, as I read his decision, and again, this is outside of my knowledge, that any kind of, to put it in just plain language, that any kind of relationship that might have predeceased a decision for being just hiring Wade is in of itself problematic. That seems to be his argument in the second half of the order. But it seems what you're saying is that is in fact not a true legal argument.
I think the way you're reading it, it's conflating two arguments that could, either one of which could be true, but they're not if they're conflated. So
okay.
It would be true that if Prosecutor Willis could benefit financially from having hired Wade, then that would be an actual conflict of interest that should disqualify her. But Judge McAfee specifically and expressly found that wasn't true.
Right. Yes.
And then secondarily, you know, even if that isn't true, if there's an appearance that could be true, that the ordinary reasonable observer would perceive it that way, then that could be a ground for taking action. But what I'm saying is, I think he misanalyzed that part because.
So what you're saying is an ordinary reasonable person could not make that.
Could not make, because remember, the allegation of what the conflict would be that the conflict is that the prosecutor's office would intentionally delay and drag out the proceedings to the detriment of the defendant. So
in the second half of his judgment, so this is not an argument with you personally, right? But in the second half of his judgment, as I read it, and again, as a non-legal scholar, I freely recognize that, he seems to divorce it of that piece. In other words, it doesn't seem that has to be what the reasonable person, he just seems to be suggesting of any compromising influences in the second half of his order. So what you're suggesting is.
I think that's just wrong.
Okay. And that's what I was trying to get at was, I was wondering, is this something that I'm reading wrong, which is always a possibility, right? We're reading a technical documents here, or is this an area where, you know, you're saying, I think actually McAfee gets this portion of it wrong. I'm just trying to make sure I understood.
Yeah, I think he gets this portion of it wrong. Okay. I think if he found that Willis was somehow benefiting in a monetary or material way, then there'd be an actual conflict of interest. But he actually found the opposite. He found that didn't happen. And so then when he moves on to, well, would it appear that that's happening? I think he goes too broad here because he ends up saying
he is very broad. I agree. Yeah. I agree.
He's saying, would it appear to people that there's something shady about the prosecutor having a relationship with the DA having a relationship with the special prosecutor that she hired? But I think that's just the wrong question. It's not whether people would think that that was shady because people disapprove of extramarital relationships or of employee-employer relationships. It would have to be something that in fact would relate to the fairness of the trial, right? And the fact that she's having a relationship with Wade does not inherently have anything to do with the fairness of the trial. So that there has to be some kind of argument for, you know, how could that be perceived as having something to do with the fairness of the trial? And I think that the only real theory that's aired out is that it would be based on this idea that since she gets taken on weekend holidays by Wade and Wade gets the money to do that by working for her, that Wade would have incentives to just drag everything out so he could make more money and take her on more holidays. That's the theory that would relate the relationship to the fairness of the trial. But I think it's an incredibly implausible theory that anybody would think that, given that everybody's observing that only the defense is trying to drag things out and the prosecution's trying to keep things moving all the time.
Okay. That's interesting to me. And so I understand your disagreement with McGaffey now. And I appreciate you outlining that because I understand that part now. Okay. Interesting. I think we want to try to get at least one more story in, Ken, because another big thing this week, well, started on Monday, and that's when Whately and Laura Trump fired 60 staffers in a shift in the RNC, or the Republican National Convention. Charlie Cook, Steve Bannon, and others have applauded the move. Green wrote on X, quote, MAGA is now in control of the Republican Party, end quote. Now, the left sees this as one step, further in Trump's plan to dismantle the state. As far as Axos reported in conjunction with the Heritage Foundation, the Trump administration is going to move more swiftly into office and ensure that it's not dominated, in the words of one staffer, by those conservative Reagans or Bushes, but by those of Trump. Then, of course, on Thursday night, Michael Whately, as I mentioned, the new RNC chair who was picked by Trump, sent a 3-page memo to staff outlining the organization's focus: turnout, a united front with the Trump campaign, and an election integrity. As she put it, quote, every tool that the other side has used, we need to wield for ourselves. She went on to argue that the Grow the Vote program geared towards reaching non-traditional Republican voters and low propensity voters needs to continue. And despite what you may have heard, we are not closing our community centers. We are aggressively pursuing programs to grow our base and maximize opportunities to engage with Americans, utilizing all existing tools for our voters to cast ballots, end quote, and lays that out. And so on the one hand, I mean, this, yeah, as a presidential scholar, isn't uber surprising in today's environment, in the contemporary presidential environment. Parties bend to their presidential nominees and their presidents in office. But I think what makes this a particularly big deal is one of those is Trump's daughter-in-law, which makes us a lot closer than most past presidents. And of course, as I've already noted, the worry, I think, for many on the left, that one of the things that hurt Trump was his inexperience in making a transition, and this appears to be part of having a much more effective and surrounding with MAGA types transitional period. So, Ken, what are your thoughts?
Well, I guess I'll agree with Steve Bannon that I love this development, although from the opposite perspective of why he loves this development.
So I just want to go out here on record. This is not a prediction. This is probably the first time that you, Steve Bannon, yeah, and Major Green have all agreed on,
yes,
one thing.
There, yeah, you go. I think it literally destroys the effectiveness of the Republican Party, and I'm very glad to see it, because now you're talking about Trump, you know, having not only, you know, running all these political action committees that he can use as his personal piggy banks, but now he's got the whole Republican National Committee funds as his personal piggy bank. And he has these huge legal judgments against him. He's almost certainly going to start diverting, you know, all this money to pay those judgments. And that's money that's not available to be used then for the congressional races and things like that. It's also going to he's kind of alienated himself from the other wing of the Republican Party, which was, you know, Ronna McDaniel, you know, had a lot of fundraising prowess with kind of the corporate wing of the Republican Party.
Yes.
And so he's kind of lost those relationships a bit or tainted them. And a lot of people who are not necessarily Trumpers, but who have given money to the Republicans, I think, are a lot less likely to do it if they think that the money is just going to be used to pay Trump's legal fees than if they thought it was going to be used to support, say, state parties and things like that. And Republicans in recent years, you know, their efforts to support their state parties have been extremely effective. And I think they're cutting a lot of those off at the knees. So I am absolutely delighted by these developments.
That's fun. I guess for me, you're very optimistic that this helps. Or hurt, I shouldn't say helps, but hurts at the base Republican. I don't actually know about that. Trump and the individuals surrounding Trump always carry an air. I mean, I think back to when he was first beginning his campaign process, and I just thought, as I looked at it, and I mean, looked at it in a scholarly way, and I just thought, well, this is a joke. This is an absolute joke, and it's not going to move forward. And so I hear you. And so the one side of my analyticness says, yes, absolutely, Ken is right. You know, this follows those patterns, those problematic patterns. But on the other hand, I am continually surprised about the effectiveness of those surrounding Trump to get these kinds of things done, especially as it concerns elections. And so...
But the party doesn't exist only to serve Trump's interests. It exists to serve the interests of all the Republicans.
I agree, but but when, you know, and this is not a formalized poll. You know, a minute ago, I talked about polls in the Democratic Party. I have not looked at all of the polling data for Trump. I should have done that before the story started. But in my, again, admittedly unrepresentative samples, but large samples of individuals on the right, I don't think there is not many me left. They're just not. And I'll just give you one quick go. I teach really large intro section classes. And even here at Oklahoma Christian University, where it's not a big surprise, we're in the middle of Oklahoma. You know, this is a school that is affiliated religiously. Our center of mass is right of center, right? We are not way right of center, but we are definitely right of center. But we have a lot, or have had a lot of what you'd see as dissenting voices. We do. But when it comes to those who are self-identifying as Republicans, I don't know anyone who's not also a Trump supporter among, say, my student base. This is something I brought up on Discord. And so I hear that, Ken, but I think one of the things that we might get wrong, I think one, because I don't mean this as an attack, because I think I get this wrong too, is, you know, you're thinking of this, you know, from a leftist position, and I'm thinking of it from a, you know, a never Trumper. And I don't think we always recognize how much the contemporary Republican Party and MAGA is not quite, but almost overlapping circles.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I think the question I'm doing is a much more nuts and bolts one than a kind of philosophical one. Money has to be spent on something, and every dollar that's spent on Trump, either on his personal expenditures like paying his legal fees or on, you know, flying him around to his various rallies, you know, that's a dollar that's not spent somewhere else within the Republican Party. And I think he's going to try to chew up a lot of that. I think the very reason he sent Laura Trump in there to take over the party is so that more of the resources can be diverted to him. And that's not to say that, you know, the Republicans don't all love him, but the Republicans who are running
campaigns,
still going
to hurt them down ballot.
They need that money. And I think he's really going to starve the subsidies to the state parties, you know, just to help himself. And that means he's going to be starving his own supporters. But the fact that they're his own supporters isn't going to be the be all and end all here. They also need the money. And I think he's going to take it.
Okay. I love it. Well, Ken, as always, it's a lot of fun to do the show with you. And I hope you've had a good time.
Absolutely.
Now, for those of you who are coming to the end of the show, keep in mind, it doesn't have to be the end of the show, because if you're a supporter of the Politics Guys, you know you've got more shows coming. And that includes what Ken and I do every week. And we've been doing it for well over a year and a half now. It's been a lot of fun going through the United States Constitution. I have really loved this segment. And I think at some point in the future, we're going to package it together as a Constitution show. It's going to be a lot of fun. But that's stuff that you get, just one of many things you get by being a supporter of the Politics Guys. And if you're not a supporter, again, you don't just get things like our midweek show in the Constitution. You get things like, well, I was just mentioning in our last story, conversations on the Discord group where Mike and myself answer and deal with your questions. We love to do that. There's all kinds of really cool benefits for being a Politics Guys supporter, including you get to listen to the show without any ads. That's one of my favorites. But if you want to check all of that out, see what those different tiers get you, you can head to patreon.com/politicsguys. Again, that's patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support the show in a variety of other ways, including on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. You can support the show through PayPal. All of those support links are in the show notes, or you can find them at politicsguys.com/support. But again, if you want to see all the different fun things you get, and I'll even encourage you, you know, maybe you are a supporter of the Politics Guys, make sure you're doing all the fun things that are available to you by heading to your Patreon account at patreon.com/politicsguys and just seeing what is there. Now, I know that for some of you, before the show started, Ken and I were talking about my finances. They are not large. And so, you know, supporting things are not easy. And I try to do that myself. But if you're just not in a position to do that, and I get it. I got three kids. I don't make a lot of money. We have a possibility for that as well. You can actually reach out to mail@politicsguys.com. Tell us what's going on about that, and we can get you that midweek show. Mike loves setting it up with that, and then I send those out as well. Now, whether you're a supporter or not, something that's a really, really big deal, and I don't think people realize how big of a deal it is, that's subscribing, rating, and reviewing. As a matter of fact, if you've only rated, if you've only subscribed, you know, going in and writing a review, that's a really big deal for the Politics Guys. That's a really big deal for us. So whatever podcast app you use, maybe use more than one, rate us on both. It just takes a couple of seconds, and I know that's annoying. It's like that pop-up you see all the time, but it's a huge deal. And then also don't forget, if there's something that we've talked about that you're really interested in, share that piece of it and pop it out there on the social media of your choice. If you've got a question, comment, correction, gripe, or anything else you'd like to share with us, don't forget you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also available on Facebook and X. You will find all of those links in the show notes. Our wonderful executive producers, and they are, of the Politics Guys, are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We will be back with a new episode next week. I hope you'll join us then.